Today, the soft underbelly of the Australian economy. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. There's a lot of information coming out which suggests that all is not as well as the Reserve Bank or even the government would want us to believe. For example, hundreds of thousands of Aussies are likely to fall into poverty when Job Seeker and Job Keeper comes to an end, according to recent ANU research. It's a dire forecast that shows hundreds of thousands of Australians could fall below the poverty line when government subsidies end in a few weeks. And it's back to September 2020 when they did the analysis. It was done by the Australian National University, forecasting that 740,000 Aussies would be pushed into poverty. And they said that it's still the same today. The economy is a bit stronger and unemployment is a bit lower than predicted. But our conclusions basically hold ANU's Centre for Social Research and Methods, Matthew Gray, said. The analysis showed that the big increase in poor Aussies would occur when the dual schemes of Job Seeker Supplements and Job Keeper ends after March. Mr. Gray and colleagues Ben Phillips and Nicholas Biddle calculated that the coronavirus supplement to Job Seeker and the JobKeeper programs together saved about 2.2 million people from falling below the poverty line in the first few months of the pandemic. Their analysis, which was published in The Conversation as the Job Seeker supplement was about to be wound down, showed that slashing Job Seeker and Job Keeper would increase the total number of Aussies in poverty from 1.1 million to 1.84 million. Given that the economy turned out stronger than the researchers anticipated, the number of Australians pushed into poverty will likely be slightly fewer than the 740,000. Indeed, the latest unemployment figures from December show that 6.6% of Australians were out of a job. Another 8.5% didn't have enough work. Now, of course, JobKeeper is a wage subsidy program for businesses that was launched in late March after the coronavirus pandemic had begun disrupting Australian life. The initial six-month run was extended in September to run through to the end of March 2021, but that will be it for the program, Treasurer Frydenberg has already said. Based on what we know today, there should be no expectation that JobKeeper will be extended beyond the end of March, he told ABC Insiders last week. It's always been a temporary program. He said the program had dished out about $80 billion and supported more than 3.5 million Aussies. JobSeeker is an unemployment payment scheme that replaced the New Start allowance in March last year. A coronavirus supplement that boosted JobSeeker payments significantly has been steadily reduced and will disappear completely by the end of March. Frydenberg had previously said the federal government hopes more jobs will be created even as JobKeeper runs out. That would happen through a combination of tax cuts, supplementary payments to certain people on income support, and measures to prompt businesses to hire extra workers, he said. And of course, there is now discussion about extra support for particular industry groups, for example, tourism. But nevertheless, the outlook does look pretty bleak. And it's also pretty bleak in SME land. Small businesses are under pressure, they said, in the SMH, as the insolvency threat mounts. Grey clouds are hovering despite recent company results and sales data suggesting that the retail sector is experiencing a sunny patch following months of souped-up spending by stimulus-flushed shoppers. In November, retail sales rose a huge 13.3% as Victorians emerged from lockdown and Black Friday sales surged. Major retailers such as Solomon Lew's Premier Investments have revelled in the unexpected boon, reporting huge jumps in profits and sales, especially online. Smaller operators such as gyms, travel agents and fashion boutiques could be set to struggle, though, in the coming months as stimulus measures wear off. Their decline could severely weaken some of the country's largest shopping centres and their multi-billion dollar owners. A study of Australia's 31 largest shopping centres by independent property research collective PAR Group shows small businesses make up 37% of stores in those malls. Smaller fashion brands such as Autograph, Alice McCall and Zinnemann account for another 18%, while large retail chains such as Vodafone and Flight Centre make up just 17% of retailers. The authors, Rob Ellis, Damien Stone and Anthony DeFresco, warn this reliance on small businesses could pose an issue for landlords if retail conditions begin to decline. This has ramifications for shopping centre owners as they face the risk of store closures by small businesses which have insufficient financial reserves to trade profitably in a post-COVID-19 retail environment, they said. And while some businesses, big and small, are sitting pretty after their biggest trading period of the year, as 2021 drags on, the risks of insolvency grows. The first quarter of the calendar year is often a boon time for collapses, says Quartermentha partner Scott Langdon, a trend he attributes to retailers needing to furiously restock and set their product strategy for the year ahead, following the Christmas rush, along with a more emotive element. Retailers have just gone through their best sales and profit period for the year and are faced with another 9 or 10 months before they get back to it, he says. They feel like there's a long slog ahead. Langdon expects this trend to be no different in 2021, although slightly delayed, predicting an increase in insolvencies and administrations when much of the government's stimulus and other COVID-19 relief slowly wears off. In 2021, we'll see a polarising of the retail market and we'll see an increase in insolvencies or administrations, he said. The stronger will get stronger and those who have archaic or underdeveloped business plans will struggle and struggle fast in this ever-changing retail environment. And figures from corporate regulator the Australian Securities and Investments Commission released recently augur trouble ahead. There were 120 insolvencies for the final 2 weeks of December, as much as triple the amount reported for the same time 2 weeks in 2019. Temporary safe harbour provisions relieving company directors of their duty to prevent insolvency trading has also worn off, increasing pressure on businesses that may have relied on them to weather a COVID downturn. Olivia Hitchens, a principal at specialist retail law firm Hitch Advisory, agrees with Langdon's prognosis. She says there is a huge delineation between retailers with a good online offering and those without. Small businesses with a good online presence have done well. Those without an online presence who rely on shopping centre traffic have done badly, she said. If you don't have an online presence, are not unique, and are relying on foot traffic, you will do it tough. I know people who kept their doors open by using JobKeeper payments for themselves and their staff, but COVID is accelerating closures that were likely to have happened to some businesses anyway, she says. Hitchens said insolvencies will play catch-up as they have been delayed by the presence of JobKeeper and the government's safe harbour provisions. In a recent note to investors, Citi analysts Adrian Dark, Sarij Nahemini and Ashok Agrawal point out there is now an oversupply of retail space in shopping malls. Vacancy rates are elevated and likely to rise further, along with a decline in tenant quality and an increase in temporary tenancies. More store closures are expected as chains rationalise their portfolios. Larger retailers will end up taking a greater share of shopping centre space as small businesses close, accelerating a generally negative trend for malls. We expect the market to be in the tenants' favour, with falling rents and or rising incentives for some time, the city analyst said. Another key indicator of distress are disputes lodged by commercial landlords and tenants under the government's commercial tenancy relief scheme. Victorian Small Business Commissioner Judy O'Connell says since March last year, the commission has received more than 14,400 COVID related inquiries. Some 3,296 small business owners and landlords have lodged applications to resolve rent disputes, and of those, 890 were resolved with early advice, and another 864 settled in mediations, he says. About 2,367 requests for mediation have been filed in New South Wales, of which 90% were resolved without going to court, the state's Small Business Commissioner, Chris Lamont, says. We encourage eligible landlords who come to new arrangements with their impacted tenants to apply for the available land tax relief over the coming months, he said. However, despite the potential trials facing the country's small businesses, not all in the sector are pessimistic about their health. James Stewart, KPMG's head of restructuring, is far more sanguine about their prospects. We'll see some insolvencies because it's inevitable, but I would be surprised if we got a big rush. It'll be a far softer landing than people think, he says. It's more likely to be a gradual unfolding of some businesses that were vulnerable anyway, and as the stimulus runs off, it just exposed it. It's like that classic Warren Buffett quote, only when the tide goes out do you discover who's been swimming naked. And elsewhere, office markets around the country have been caught in the crossfire, with the supply of fresh space pumping into CBDs at pre-COVID-19 levels, even as demand turned negative in all the capitals but Canberra. The Property Council of Australia's biannual office market report, which was released on Thursday, will be one of its most eagerly anticipated in some time, telling the story of how CBD office markets weathered the disruption. Vacancy rates have risen around the country. Sydney is at 8.6% and Melbourne at 8.2%, both more than double where they were a year ago before the upheaval began. The other capitals have all experienced higher vacancy rates, except Canberra, which has tracked sideways at 10.1% as federal departments took up new accommodation. While it's not a surprise to see office vacancies increase in the middle of a pandemic, it's the new supply of office space that is responsible for three quarters of this impact, not reduced tenancy demand, the Property Council's Chief Executive Ken Morrison said. COVID-19 has reduced demand for office space as businesses downsize, but this has had a smaller influence on vacancy rates than the new supply coming on stream. While the top-line vacancy rates were largely expected, the innards of the Property Council report reveal considerable nuance about where the market has been most vulnerable to disruption and points to how it might recover. Significantly, all capital cities recorded higher vacancy in secondary stock over prime stock, which is welcome news to major landlords who are heavily into newer prime-grade buildings. Melbourne's CBD was the largest amount and greatest proportion of new supply coming on. Over the next 3 years, close to 400,000 square metres will arrive, representing 8% of the current stock. Little more than one-third of that is pre-committed. By contrast, more than half of Sydney's three-year pipeline is spoken for. And sublease space, the most volatile corner of the market, has surged to its highest vacancy in 4 years, rising more sharply in Sydney and Melbourne. Further analysis of the data, which was requested by the Australian Financial Review, showed that the proportion of overall vacancy accounted for by sublease is also well above its historic averages in those two central business districts. Luke Briscoe, the Chief Operating Officer for AMP Capital's real estate arm, happily confirms that prime office space has been relatively immune from the vacancy hit. A greater proportion of renewals has been struck rather than entirely new leases. As well, landlords and their tenants are in some cases striking leases of between 18 months and 2 to 3 years, much shorter than the typical five-year period. The flexibility is good for tenants. They are not locked in while their own future is uncertain, but it also benefits landlords too. If we can push a lease expiry out 2 to 3 years, both parties are hopeful that business sentiment and the real estate market gets back to more normalised levels, he said. This means that a business will have greater comfort in committing to a longer-term lease, and for landlords, the lease can be agreed at a time when incentive levels aren't elevated and vacancy has reduced. And Holly Bailey, a tenant advisor for Cornell Property, who has recently moved to Melbourne from Sydney, is less confident the bubble of sublease space will ease quickly, and said vacancy rates in the two capitals will still seem artificially low. We don't think this is anything like a bottom, and they will continue to fall from here, she said. Sydney and Melbourne have the large global influence, which will have a downward trend on occupancy this year and going forward. And the boom in e-commerce and the increasing impatience of consumers expecting same-day delivery for goods ordered online is set to fuel another year of record take-up of industrial space in 2021 as companies look to optimize and automate their supply chains. According to Colliers International, for every $1 billion spent on online sales, about 85,000 square meters of warehouse space is needed. Prime logistics facilities will be among the most sought-after assets in 2021. We are forecasting online sales to grow by $12.8 billion in 2021, which will result in demand for about 1 million square meters of warehouse demand from e-commerce alone in 2021, said Malcolm Tyson, Managing Director of Industrial at Colliers International. While mega shed deals like the 200,000 square meter Sydney fulfillment center Goodman is building for Amazon help lift the gross national take-up of warehouse space to a record 2.86 million square meters in 2020, according to JLL figures, Travis Edridge, Managing Director of Logistics Consultancy TM Insight, believes 2021 could see a greater proliferation of regional and inner suburban fulfillment centers closer to end customers in a hub and spoke supply chain model. This means a greater industrial footprint and increasing demand for warehousing in capital cities and in the inner city areas, he said. Gone are the days of overly lean supply chains, and instead flexibility is key. Businesses need an agile supply chain that can cope with new demands of the consumer. Alongside this expansion of a warehouse network, TM Insights believes there will be an increasing uptake of automation, though it will be used more selectively as part of a fit-for-purpose set of solutions. For organizations where there is more volatility in the inventory and risk involved, this may lead them away from full automation, whereas in the past, this may have been driven purely by financial metrics, he said. More organizations may look to adopting mobile automation, which is flexible and scalable, in the sense that you add more or less robots according to how your business is performing. And on the investment front, the logistics sector also expects to boom again as institutional and private investors look to further reweight their portfolios to an asset class which delivers double-digit total returns during the pandemic, while retail property returns turn sharply negative. As at December 2020, there was approximately $26 billion in capital looking to invest in the sector and broadly spread between offshore and domestic institutions as well as private investors, said Mr. Tyson. Given this, additional assets from corporate groups are expected to be brought into the market in 2021 as the group looks to capitalise on the continued strength of the industrial and logistics market. This includes a groundbreaking multi-billion dollar portfolio of 45 mostly East Coast logistics assets being shopped around by US giant Blackstone, according to the Australian Financial Review's Street Talk column. And JLL is forecasting national average prime yields in 2021 to continue to compress to sub 5% by the end of this year. They tightened 41 basis points to 5.06% in 2020, and sales volumes to match the $4.2 billion achieved in 2020. Offshore capital sources will be an active buyer cohort for the Australian industrial and logistics sector in 2021, said JLL. Australia is the beneficiary of two major investment themes, higher allocation of real assets and a portfolio reweighting towards Asia Pacific. The expectation that Asia Pacific recoveries will recover more quickly than Western countries is an additional driver. The government is set to reissue unused first home loan deposit scheme guarantees. It's been revealed that the government is to reissue unused guarantees from the first tranche of the first deposit home loan scheme in the coming days. The Assistant Treasurer and Minister of Housing, Michael Sukkar, has announced that the federal government is to reissue unused first home loan deposit scheme guarantees from the 2019-20 financial year. Under the first tranche of the scheme, which ran from the 1st of February to the 1st of July 2020, 10,000 places were made available to help first home buyers purchase or build a new home with a deposit as little as 5%. Under the scheme, the government guaranteed up to 15% to the value of the property to help borrowers secure a loan without having to pay lenders' mortgage insurance in a bid to help more borrowers enter the property market faster. The first tranche of the scheme proved very popular, with initial places in the scheme reserved within 4 months of launching. The broker channel drove about half of all applications to the scheme in 2019-20. However, nearly 2,000 guarantees were not finalised due to first home buyers not settling on their purchase for one reason or another. Minister Sukkar commented, "Since the commencement of the scheme a year ago, there's been an extraordinary take-up of guarantees by first home buyers, with more than 15,000 first home buyers already settled and moved into their homes since the 1st of January 2020. To further support first home buyers, the Morrison government will reissue unused guarantees from the 2019-20 financial year from buyers who have since been unable to complete their purchase of their first home. This represents a great opportunity for around 1,800 buyers to now enter the property market sooner. First home buyers will be able to apply for these guarantees from the scheme's lending panel lenders in the coming days, and further details as to how to apply will be released later. As part of the Morrison government's economic recovery plan to create jobs, rebuild the economy and secure Australia's future, the second phase of the scheme was extended so that an additional 10,000 first home buyers could purchase or build a new home with a guaranteed loan until the end of this financial year. And the second tranche for the financial year 2021 comprises two parts: 10,000 places for those seeking to purchase a new existing home available until the 30th of June 2021, and 10,000 places for those seeking to purchase or build a new home under the First Home Loan Deposit Scheme for new homes. And according to the Treasury, over 4,200 first home buyers have accessed the extended scheme to build or buy a new home since it was launched 3 months ago. And Sukkar commented, "The Morrison government's commitment to backing first home buyers is delivering results, helping Australians get into a home of their own, and supporting tradies' jobs are both key priorities for the Morrison government as we build our comeback from the COVID-19 recession." The scheme, along with other government support schemes and grants like the First Home Super Saver Scheme, Home Builder Grant, or State and Territory First Home Owner Grants and Stamp Duty Concessions, have contributed to a surge in first home buyer activity, as we reported recently. According to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, first home buyers continue to enter the market at the highest level since 2009, with the number of owner-occupied first-home buyer loans commitments rising 9.3%. This was an increase of 56.6% from the same time last year, and major banks such as NAB and CBA, who are the only two majors who took part in the scheme, have also reported strong first-home buyer activity. NAB recently revealed that lending to first-home buyers increased by 21%, against their 12-month average, with regional areas across the nation recording a 44% increase in first home buyer activity. Meanwhile, CBA has recently recorded a sharp rise in its owner-occupied lending portfolio, which grew from $304.6 billion in November 2020 to around $307 billion in December 2020. This was in part due to first home buyer activity. And finally, two Westpac subsidiaries have lost their appeal in the High Court and have been found to have breached financial services law. Westpac is facing penalties for breaching its AFSL conditions after losing appeal over whether its subsidiaries Westpac Securities Administration Limited and BT Funds Management Limited breached financial services laws, including the requirement to act in their clients' best interest and the requirements to act honestly, efficiently and fairly. The High Court issued its judgment on Wednesday when it ruled that the Big Four bank subsidiary had provided personal advice to members when they were not licensed to do so. The case was brought by ASIC and concerned two campaigns where Westpac had contacted 15 members via phone and advised each person to accept an offer to roll over their external superannuation accounts into their account with the Big Four bank. As a result of the campaigns, Westpac reportedly increased its funds under management by almost $650 million between January 2013 and the 16th of September 2016. Westpac had appealed a federal court decision that the financial product advice given to Superfund members over the phone qualified as personal advice in breach of its Australian financial services licence. ASIC has first alleged that Westpac and BT Funds Management had breached the best interest duties in 2016 by recommending that customers roll over their superannuation into Westpac's related accounts without undertaking a proper comparison of the funds as required by the law. The corporate regulator has also argued that the group violated its license conditions through providing personal advice to customers. The Federal Court ruled in favour of Westpac and BT Funds Management in 2019, finding they did not supply personal advice during the phone calls and that it had fallen under general advice. However, after ASIC appealed that decision, the full court reversed the ruling in 2019, finding that during calls to 14 to 15 of the customers, Westpac staff had provided personal advice in breach of the company's Australian financial services licence. Personal advice is defined under the Corporations Act, which includes financial product advice given to a person in circumstances where a reasonable person might expect the provider to have considered one or more of the person's objectives, financial situations and needs, as opposed to general advice, where the product advice is not accounting for personal circumstances. The Corporations Act imposes more onerous obligations on advisors who provide personal advice, obligations which Westpac accepted it had breached if it indeed provided personal and not general advice. But the High Court's new ruling stated the word considered in the Corporations Act referred not to an active process of evaluation and reflection, but rather meant taking account of. A reasonable person in the position of each of the members called by Westpac might expect Westpac to have in fact taken into account at least one aspect of the members' objectives, financial situations and needs, the High Court statement read. The phone calls further engendered the expectation that Westpac had accounted for members' circumstances, with the court noting that the bank had pre-existing relationship with members and had referenced members' desires to save on fees and improve the manageability of their super. Westpac staff had proceeded to confirm the validity of the expressed objective and appropriateness of the rollover services to achieve them, and then segued into an offer to elect the rollover, the court statement said. That the members' objectives were generic or generally applicable did not mean they ceased being personal objectives capable of giving rise to the expectation, the judgment concluded. The general advice statement was given only once at the beginning of the telephone conversation. Members were subsequently asked directly about their personal objectives, and members were not encouraged to seek personal advice before deciding whether to accept the rollover service. Westpac acknowledged the decision on Wednesday, stating the High Court had provided important guidance on the distinction between general and personal advice. And ASIC also echoed the importance of the judgment by marking out the divide between personal and general advice. By clarifying the distinction between tailored, quality, personal advice in the customer's interest and general advice via a sales campaign, today's judgment will provide clear guidance to those financial institutions that develop campaigns to sell financial products through direct approaches to retail clients, they said. An ASIC will continue to bring enforcement actions against misconduct, including advice that is not in the best interest of clients. As noted by the High Court, consumers' decisions regarding superannuation accounts are significant financial decisions, and ASIC has a focus to lift standards in this area. The proceedings will now be remitted to the Federal Court for a further hearing, where ASIC will seek orders for penalties. So standing back, couple of important points there. Firstly, of course, the banks continue to demonstrate their inability to act in the best interests of their customers. We see it in spades. And more broadly, whilst at the top line, the Reserve Bank can talk about the economy recovering, when you come down the level, you can see all sorts of cracks appearing, be it those households who are still in difficulty, small businesses struggling with their businesses. And indeed, if you look at the commercial real estate sector, there are cracks there too. So I continue to believe that we are not out of the woods yet. It's a long way to go. And possibly we've still got more downside economic shocks ahead, irrespective of the situation with the virus. And of course, as I've said previously, if the virus comes bouncing back, that's going to create an even bigger headache too. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.